Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Fed's announcement that it is continuing to pump $85 billion a month into the bond market, which prompted share prices to surge on Wall Street. Robert Kuttner, a former chief investigator for the Senate Banking Committee, who wrote a column for Business Week for 20 years, joins us to discuss whether quantitative easing is a subsidy for Wall Street that could be better invested in Main Street, and his article at the Huffington Post, Summer's End. Then we'll examine the international backlash to the extent of NSA surveillance on foreigners that has caused Brazil's president to cancel a state visit to Washington and call for the creation of a BRICS internet that would link Brazil, India, China, and South Africa. Gigi Sohn, the co-founder and president of Public Knowledge, joins us to discuss the collateral damage to America's technology companies and our internet-fueled economy, not to mention the future of freedom of information on the internet that Russia, China, Sudan, and Saudi Arabia want to control and censor. Then finally, Kate Gould, the legislative associate for Middle East Policy for the Friends Committee on National Legislation, a Quaker lobby that fields the largest team of registered peace lobbyists in Washington, joins us to discuss the challenging prospects for peace in Syria and hopeful signs from Iran, particularly their silence on Assad's use of chemical weapons against Syrian civilians that the Russians are still insisting was a provocation by the rebels. And joining us now is Robert Kuttner, the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect. He was formerly an assistant to the legendary I.F. Stone, a chief investigator for the Senate Banking Committee, and for 20 years wrote a column for Business Week. Robert Kuttner is the author of 8 books, including his latest, A Presidency in Peril, The Insider Story of Obama's Promise, Wall Street's Power, and The Struggle to Control Our Economic Future. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Summer's End, and another at Reuters, Yellen, an economic tonic for the sluggish recovery. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Kuttner.
Oh, delighted to be here, and you're leaving out my most important credit.
Which is?
One-time Washington bureau chief for an outfit called Pacifica Radio.
Well, I feel chastened, I must say. Well, thank you.
Well, I tell you, I feel really good because it's been a long time since we've won anything, and to block Summers, and now it really looks like we're going to get Yellen. That's just really good news.
So let me ask you whether or not what the Fed announced, that is that they continue this QE, quantitative easing,
yeah.
And of course the market and the Dow Jones and the S&P indexes hitting record highs as the U.S. share prices jumped on this news that the Fed's going to continue its $85 billion a month bond purchases. Now, excuse me for being naive, Robert Kuttner, but I would think $85 billion a month invested in Main Street would help America a lot more than $85 billion a month invested in Wall Street.
Well, that's exactly the right question. And let's distinguish between ending these bond purchases prematurely as one policy, continuing them as another policy, and coming up with something even better as a third policy. So it is too soon to end them because the real economy is still very weak, and even though that money gets pumped into conventional money markets and is the equivalent of printing money, it's better than nothing because it drives down interest rates across the board. Now, on the one hand, Wall Street loves that because low interest rates are correlated with a firm bond market, and they're also correlated with high stock prices. The money markets were worried that these bond purchases were going to be terminated early because the markets, paradoxically, had been lobbying for that because they're afraid that if this goes on too long, at some point there will be what is euphemistically called a correction, and the markets will stop trusting the Fed, and then interest rates will go up. So on the one hand, it's good not just for Wall Street. It's good for folks who, you know, are trying to find a mortgage, and it's good for people who are buying cars because they're good deals on interest rates. Helps consumers a little bit. But your question is absolutely right, Ian. It would be much better if the Fed could find a way of pumping this money directly into Main Street. It's something I've written about. It's something that the more progressive people at the Fed have looked into. and they just don't have the votes. For example, suppose you had mortgage securities that could allow people to refinance underwater homes and get principal reduction, and you know, the Fed would agree to buy those bonds directly. Or suppose that the Fed bought a special issue of bonds that would go to finance consumer and small business lending on the part of community banks. So the Fed could be a lot more creative in making sure that this money reduces credit costs for regular people, gets loans out into the community rather than just pumping up the money markets. But the progressives at the Fed, and there are a few, I've interviewed them, they just don't have the votes. I can tell you and your listeners, this has been discussed, and the Fed rejected it. Now, I think the good news with Yellen being the presumptive chair is that she is more aggressive on this stuff. I mean, if you read her speeches, particularly the amazing speech she gave in February at the AFL-CIO, not a typical venue for Fed vice chairs, you know, it reads like something you or I might have written. I mean, basically, Yellen said, the Fed traditionally is obsessed with inflation. Right now, there's no inflation. The bigger problem is unemployment. We got to do something more aggressive about unemployment. She started out as a labor economist. That's not a typical background for a Fed chairman. So, you know, I don't want to turn cartwheels. I mean, this is not Paul Krugman being Fed chairman, but it's pretty darn good.
So would you consider her, though, one of the progressives at the Fed?
Absolutely. She's Bernanke only more so. I mean, Bernanke's a very interesting case of a guy who started out as a conservative, as a kind of a Milton Friedman admirer, but he's an honest man, and he had an encounter with reality. And he realized that all the deregulation had been catastrophic for the economy. He's part of the group at the Fed that wants tighter bank regulation. And he also realized that with the rest of the government doing this deficit reduction and fiscal tightening, that creates headwinds for the recovery. And so very cheap money is really all we've got. And so the Fed is stepping into the vacuum created by bad fiscal policy. And the people who back Bernanke on this include Yellen and Daniel Tarullo, who's another relatively progressive governor, and Sarah Raskin, who's the most progressive of the governors, works very closely with Yellen. And so there's a working majority in favor of stimulating. There's not a working majority in favor of pumping money directly into Main Street. And the reason there was all this noise about maybe it's time to end these bond purchases is that some of the other members of the Fed's Open Market Committee, which is the committee that sets policy, particularly some of the more conservative regional Federal Reserve Bank presidents who were on the Open Market Committee, had been saying, all right, we've done enough of this, we're risking inflation, we better pull back. But I think a majority of the Open Market Committee realized that job creation and wages are still dismal, and we've got a long way to go before we have a recovery that reaches regular people. So in sum, these bond purchases are better than nothing, but they're far from the most efficient way of getting real money out to real people, and they do risk pumping up a stock market bubble. That's why Wall Street likes them so much.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Cutton, who's the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect, who is formerly an assistant to the legendary I.F. Stone, a chief investigator for the Senate Banking Committee, and for 20 years wrote a column for Business Week. He has an article.
I'm a former Pacifica bureau chief in Washington.
I was about to get to that.
All right.
But I wanted to mention your articles because people can get them through ianmasters.com.
Right.
And that is your article at the Huffington Post, Summer's End, and another at Reuters, Yellen, an economic tonic for the sluggish recovery. So are you telling us then that what Bernanke and the Fed are doing are trying to undo, if you will, the boneheaded House of Representatives who seem to have done everything they could to sabotage President Obama's efforts to stimulate the economy?
Well, Ian, it's not just the boneheaded House of Representatives. It's the boneheaded President Obama, because Obama, you know, is the guy who appointed the Bolt-Simpson Commission. Obama's the guy who said we need $4 trillion of deficit reduction. So even though the Republicans are truly lunatic, Obama's fiscal policy, putting deficit reduction ahead of growth, is nothing to be proud of either. It's just less crazy.
Right, and he suffered from it too. That's the bizarre thing.
We suffered.
Right, I know, but I mean, politically he suffered. We of course, are the last people that anybody in Washington seems to think about.
Well, I mean, we suffered in the sense that the weak recovery policy cost the Democrats their working majority in the House. The Republicans took over, and that was because they let up on the accelerator pedal prematurely. And people felt that the recovery wasn't reaching them, and people were right.
So, but it can get worse, can't it? At the end of this month, they're threatening, the Republicans in the House are threatening either to defund Obamacare or tie the Keystone XL pipeline in. Obama said he's not going to negotiate over the debt ceiling. So who knows? Are they?
Well, I think for once, the Republicans have totally overreached. And for once, Obama is going to hang tough, because the thing that they are holding hostage is not, you know, some minor program like Social Security or Medicare, where Obama just might cut a deal with them, but it's his baby. It's his crown jewel. It's Obamacare. So he's not going to negotiate on that, and the Republicans are split several different ways between the pragmatists who realize that if they shut down the government and Obama calls their bluff, they bear the damage. I mean, polls show that by a margin of about 20 points, voters say that if the government shuts down, they're going to blame the Republicans. And also, you know, even though Obamacare is being demonized, you've got one right-wing Republican governor after another who is cooperating with Obamacare to expand Medicaid, because Medicaid doesn't just help welfare people, who it's easy for Republicans to demonize. Given the insecurity of health coverage, the Medicaid expansion that has to be administered by the states, but it's being paid for by Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, you know, that reaches well into the working middle class. It's popular. And so you've got really far-right Republicans like Jan Brewer in Arizona, Rick Scott in Florida, Rick Snyder in Michigan, and John Kasich in Ohio, none of whom is by any stretch even a moderate, all agreeing to expand Medicaid. So not only do you have a split between the Republican leadership and the Tea Party, which controls a majority of the caucus in the House, but you also have a split between the Tea Party caucus in the House and Republican governors in very important states. And I think, in spite of himself, Obama may actually hang tough this time, and the Republicans might just make fools out of themselves. So it's been a good week, Ian.
Well, but my understanding, though, is that the, and you referred to them as lunatics, and that may not be unkind.
Understatement.
Well, the House Republicans, lunatics or otherwise, they don't pay a political price.
Oh, yes, they do.
Not in their districts. I mean, they've got the Club for Growth breathing down their backs. They've got the Koch brothers funding Americans for Prosperity. Why do the Koch brothers want to tank the entire economy?
The Koch brothers don't want to tank the entire economy. They want to tank the government. But there's one little bit of information that people leave out when they say that the Tea Party Republicans couldn't care less because they have safe seats. They like being part of the majority. They get to be committee chairs. They get to pass all this stupid legislation, you know, to defund Obamacare and all the rest of the stuff. But if they behave crazily enough, the Democrats take back the House and they cease being the majority. So I think even some of the crazies, after they shut down the government, assuming that they proceed with this and Obama calls their bluff, and after the Republicans become massively unpopular because they're so extreme, they're going to be even in more disarray. They're going to be even more split between the pragmatists and the extremists, and we may actually gain some traction.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Robert
Kuttner.
Pleasure.
Always a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Kuttner, who's the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect. He was formerly an assistant to the legendary I.F. Stone, a chief investigator for the Senate Banking Committee, and for 20 years wrote a column for Business Week. He's the author of 8 books, including his latest, A Presidency in Peril, The Insider Story of Obama's Promise, Wall Street's Power, and The Struggle to Control Our Economic Future. He was also Pacifica Radio's bureau chief in Washington, D.C., and he has an article at the Huffington Post, Summer's End, and another at Reuters, Yellen, an economic tonic for the sluggish recovery. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the growing international backlash against NSA surveillance that may hurt us more than the damage to our civil liberties.
You never give me your money. You only give me your funny paper. And in the middle of negotiations, you break down. I never give you my number.
But why do I always feel like I'm in the twilight zone? And
I always feel like somebody's watching me.
And I have no privacy. Oh,
I always feel like somebody's watching me.
Tell me, is it just a dream? When I come home at night, I've left the door real tight. People call me on the phone.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now are Gigi Sohn, who's the co-founder and president of Public Knowledge, a Washington, D.C.-based public interest group working to defend citizens' rights in the emerging digital culture. She has served as a project specialist in the Ford Foundation's Media, Arts, and Culture Unit and as executive director of the Media Access Project, a public interest law firm that represents citizens' rights before the FCC and the courts. In 2006, the Electronic Frontier Foundation gave Gigi Sohn its Internet Pioneer Award. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gigi Sohn.
It's great to be here, Ian.
And Dilma Rousseff, the president of Brazil, has just postponed a state visit to Washington because of allegations that the U.S. National Security Agency, the NSA, has targeted her emails and her phone calls, along with NSA hacking into the state-run oil company Petrobras and intercepting billions of emails from calls made by Brazilians. So it seems like there is an international backlash either underway or developing in terms of the NSA surveillance that Edward Snowden largely revealed.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's not just Brazil, and you know, Brazil is not to be trifled with. It really is the most powerful economy in the global south. But obviously, there are a number of European countries, France and Germany. Mexico was also concerned because it was found out that the U.S. was spying on their president as well. So, yeah, there are a number of international implications for what's going on, and a number of major trading partners and major allies of the United States who are very, very concerned.
So far we've focused on the abuse of or the invasion of civil liberties here in the United States. And curiously, when the president first addressed these revelations when they broke with Edward Snowden's television comments from Hong Kong, the defensive mode of the government was to reassure American people and citizens that we're not spying on you, we're spying on foreigners, which seems like the foreigners heard that, right?
Yeah, I think that's really backfired a lot, because now what you've got is countries like Brazil are saying to United States companies, internet companies like Google and Facebook, is, you know, if you want to have any data on our citizens, you have to keep servers in our country. You know, we're not sure that we want to have a trade agreement with you. You know, the United States and the European Union, we're going to enter into a trade agreement, and now that's really up in the air. Another thing that's up in the air, and this is really critically important, you know, some people, you know, some of your listeners might say, I don't really care, you know, how costly this is to Google or Facebook. Well, that's fine, but to the extent that the United States was rightly fighting an effort by Russia and China and repressive Arab countries to have one centralized body controlling the Internet, this could have a huge impact on the United States' effort to make sure that the Internet is controlled in a decentralized manner with multi-stakeholder groups, rather than have this International Telecommunications Union, which, again, companies like, you know, China and Russia and others will have, you know, a great deal to say about how the Internet is run We're starting to lose those allies because of what's been going on with the NSA and the spying. And in the final decision on who gets to control the Internet is going to be made next year. And unless the president does something to mollify our international allies and partners, I'm afraid that control of the Internet is going to land up in this centralized body, and that will not be good for anybody.
And Gigi Sun, you're referring to the International Telecommunications Union meeting last December in Dubai, where an emerging cyber sovereignty movement raised its head, where Russia, China, the United Arab Emirates, Sudan, and Saudi Arabia unsuccessfully pushed for changes in the Internet infrastructure.
That's correct. Well, they were somewhat successful, but not as successful as they wanted to be. And, you know, unfortunately, and, you know, again, the United States is to blame in part for this, there is a thought, even among many of our allies, that the U.S. controls the Internet too much. It controls ICANN, which is the body that gives out, domain names. And this NSA spying kind of feeds the fire. It fuels the fire that, oh, my gosh, the United States has too much control over the Internet. So in Dubai, the United States was largely successful in keeping out regulations that would have vested too much power into the International Telecommunications Union. But the issue is not dead yet. The countries meet again next year in Seoul, South Korea, to finalize these regulations, and things could turn in the wrong direction, again, in the direction of these repressive regimes, unless the president and the administration do something to make our international allies, the folks that were on our side in Dubai, feel better about not having centralized control over the Internet.
Again, I'm speaking with Gigi Sohn, who's the co-founder and president of Public Knowledge, a Washington, D.C.-based public interest group working to defend citizens' rights in the emerging digital culture. Now, so I guess it's pretty clear then that violating foreigners' privacy is both bad for our national security and for our prosperity, because if companies, big multinational companies, not based here in the United States, they don't want their communications intercepted. It's been clear that with the Brazilian case with Petrobras, that this goes on. Aren't we in this world today, Gigi Sohn, in many ways, economic espionage is far more important, in a sense, than the traditional military and intelligence espionage?
Well, I'm not sure you can separate one from the other, right? I mean, the government pressures, you know, companies to keep, you know, to keep a lot of data and keep it forever. The companies want to keep a lot of data. I'm not sure they want to keep it forever, but, you know, they want to keep it for long periods of time. It's very, very hard to kind of separate out the two. I mean, I do think we have like a surveillance industrial complex is what I call it. If you remember, President Eisenhower talked about the military industrial complex, where we have so many, you know, companies, so nearly 500 companies are contracting with the U.S. government to do some sort of surveillance work. And the more companies you have invested in doing surveillance, the more they will surveil. Okay, they're not going to say to the government, no, we should do less surveillance, pay us less money. And I think that's a real danger. You have this mission creep, and not only more surveillance, but surveillance for reasons that have nothing to do with security. For example, maybe, you know, I understand that the Department of Justice was inquiring with the NSA about whether they could do surveillance for copyright infringement. And there was, you know, discussions about using surveillance for, you know, pornography or other sort of, you know, dirty activity. So we really, really have to watch out that we are building the surveillance industrial complex and what the implications are for even having more surveillance than what we're hearing about every day. But there's one other point, Ian, that I'd like to make that I think is really, really important. And that is, you know, Brazil has been talking about setting up its own Internet. Okay? And we already know Russia kind of has its own Internet. China has its own Internet. And I very much worry about this balkanization of the Internet, because I think what makes the Internet great is that it's a global network of networks. And, you know, I can talk to people in Africa, in Australia, and, you know, hopefully not having to worry about, you know, who's watching what I'm doing and who's watching what I'm saying. And if everybody is now going to create their own internet, there's not going to be a global network anymore. I think so much good has come of the internet's global nature. You know, democracies have flourished where there weren't any before. Economies have flourished where economies were weak before. You know, free speech has flourished where, you know, speech was tamped down before. If we're going to get away from that and go more to, you know, Brazil's internet and Australia's internet and France's internet, it's going to be like before pre-internet times, where we're just sort of in our own little sovereign communities and not learning from each other and not growing from each other. And I think that's the advantage of repressive regimes. And I think that's, you know, a really important message to take back to the administration, is that the more we do this kind of surveillance and are not transparent about what we're doing and why we're doing it, the more we play into the hands of the China and Russias of the world who want to control the internet.
Well, surely there's been some real evidence of how the internet has empowered democratic activists around the world. And look what happened in Egypt with the use of social media in their initial revolution, which, of course, sadly has been reversed recently by the military. But I remember the euphoria at the time, and everybody, you know, I even talked to Egyptian activists who were kind of peeved that we were attributing everything to Twitter and Google and Facebook and not to the fact that they were bleeding in the streets of Cairo.
Well, look, it's both, right? I mean, you know, the revolution there and the revolution in Tunisia were certainly helped by quick and easy communications and, frankly, tools, some of which were built here in the United States, that allowed activists to get around the censorship of their governments. And I will say, you know, that's one place where the United States government ought to be praised and ought to be praised greatly, is it is funding NGOs that are building the tools for activists to get around the filters, to get around the censorship of their governments. So, I mean, absolutely, I don't think anybody can doubt, you know, that the internet and its applications and its openness have really have helped to fuel these revolutions, have helped to bring information and money from outside that promote these revolutions. So I think you can't diminish the impact. But again, if you have, if all of a sudden everybody's got a separate internet, and I can't speak to the Brazilian internet or the Egyptian internet or the Tunisian internet, and a lot of that goes away, and I don't think we want to go there. So I think the president at some level understands this. I'm not sure he knows what to do about it, but it is not just about Americans, and I think Americans at their peril, when their advocacy just talks about spying on Americans and not on the international community, I think we are leaving out a lot of allies and a lot of people we want to have as allies, and we need to understand the impact on the international community. And again, when it impacts the international community, it also impacts our businesses, both big and small, and it also, in turn, impacts us.
But it does seem that one part of the government is pushing in one direction and another part of the government in another. When you've mentioned these NGOs, the State Department is putting a lot of support behind an open and uncensored internet and considers it one of its most important missions. And then you've got the NSA on the other side looking into what almost everybody around the world is doing, saying, and thinking. So obviously, this unfettered U.S. spying on foreigners is causing some serious collateral damage, isn't it?
Yes, it absolutely is causing collateral damage. Look, I talked to the internet companies. They're absolutely freaking out, and they should. They're freaking out, again, because of the way that some of the countries are treating them and their officials there. I believe that Brazil had a number of Google, Apple, and Facebook executives appear in court to talk about PRISM, you know, the PRISM program where the NSA was able to, you know, spy on the emails of these companies. So they're being hauled into court. You know, the business prerogatives are being limited. So, you know, they're really freaking out. So and that does have an impact on us. I mean, you know, these companies are huge employers in the United States. So, you know, it's not enough to say, well, their companies will take care of themselves. It has a larger impact. It also impacts any good trade initiatives we might have with some of these countries. And as I said before, it impacts the ultimate question of who will govern the internet. And you know, when we were talking about what the U.S. would do in Dubai around the International Telecommunications Union last year, left and right were absolutely united that it would not be good for the internet to have centralized control. That the ITU should have centralized control over the internet, that it would be better to make it, you know, more diffuse and more, subject to multi-stakeholder governance. There was no daylight between the left and the right there. But I fear that, you know, the administration's unwillingness to address this international problem is going to cost us dearly in Seoul next year, and could have really dramatic negative consequences for the global internet.
So is this a case, Gigi Sohn, of some of these big companies being kind of co-opted by the government and suddenly realizing it's costing them? I mean, Verizon and all these phone companies get paid to help the NSA troll through the phone records, and I believe the big Googles and Facebooks also get paid for the access that the NSA has, although it supposedly taps into these fiber optic cables. I'm not sure what the arrangements are, but it looks like they're backfiring.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think we kind of, look, obviously the companies are going to try to cover their behinds, and nobody has clean hands here. I think the telecommunications providers are more into it than the internet providers, to the extent that, for example, AT&T is a perfect example of a company that's getting a lot of government money. They are a government contractor of the NSA. So a lot of it is, you know, the telecoms are much deeper into it than the internet companies, but nobody really has clean hands. And some of what's going on, to the extent that the internet companies are asking to be able to tell the public how many data requests they get, I mean, I think that's a good thing. We actually signed a letter with those companies asking the government to allow them to do that, but still sort of a covering, you know, they're behind, you know, trying to make themselves look good when they are sort of, you know, part of this sort of larger surveillance industrial complex. But again, that is sort of a separate question about what's going on overseas to these companies and, you know, what it means for the United States standing as a leader internationally. I think we're really taking our shots. And, you know, one thing about this whole issue, it's not going away. This is not something, I do think that it's, at one point, I think the administration just thought, well, Americans care more about their security than their privacy, and this will just sort of dry up and people will forget about it. But it's not going away. It's not going away in part because, you know, Edward Snowden is allowing this information to kind of, you know, come out in little dribs and drabs. So, you know, you have, every day there's a new outrage. I actually find the most outrageous thing I've heard so far is that the NSA was working with standards bodies to try to make our internet insecure. So instead of, you know, trying to invent a better lock pick, they're actually making the locks insecure, which is amazing to me given all the focus on cybersecurity and everything. But you're getting this drip, drip, drip of information, and people are getting more and more outraged. So this thing is not going away. And while a couple weeks ago the president proposed some reforms, they fall far short of what needs to be done in order to make people feel better about their government and better about their intelligence apparatus. I don't think there's anybody who doesn't think the NSA should be spying. But I think most people think that they ought to be spying on criminals and terrorists and not ordinary Americans and not ordinary foreigners. So, and that's where this whole thing has gotten completely out of control. The FISA court's out of control, and the NSA is out of control, and it needs to be brought in control. The administration can do some things of its own, but Congress also has to act. And I think, you know, I've been beating up a lot on the administration, but, you know, the Patriot Act was passed by Congress. The FISA Amendments Act was passed by Congress. Only Congress can fix those things. So it needs to get its act together and do the right thing and cabin the scope of this surveillance, because that's the heart of what's wrong here.
Well, just in closing, Gigi Sohn, what do you think the chances are of this new proposed BRICS cable that the Brazilians are proposing, which is a fiber optic link from Brazil to Vladivostok, Russia, and then down through Asia across to Africa? and the Middle East, of course, and on to Europe.
I mean, again, it gets back to the point I made before is, you know, having separate internets doesn't help anybody. And again, if Russia's going to be a main, you know, main part of this new internet, I mean, they have other values that we don't share. You know, the internet should be, you know, a free and unfettered place for people to be able to speak their mind, for people to be able to associate with whom they want to associate with, obviously, you know, within limits when it comes to terrorism. You know, but it needs to be a global network. Otherwise, you know, the idea of the internet was for the whole world to benefit, not for one country to benefit. So I understand the reaction. I understand why they want to do it. I think ultimately it's self-defeating and could really play into the hands of repressive regimes and not freedom.
Well, Gigi Sohn, thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Gigi Sohn, who's the co-founder and president of Public Knowledge, a Washington, D.C.-based public interest group working to defend citizens' rights in the emerging digital culture. She has served as a project specialist in the Ford Foundation's Media, Arts, and Culture Unit and as executive director of the Media Access Project, a public interest law firm that represents citizens' rights before the FCC and the courts. In 2006, the Electronic Frontier Foundation gave Gigi Sohn its Internet Pioneer Award. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with the Quaker lobbyist on Capitol Hill for peace in the Middle East. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Kate Gould, the Legislative Associate for Middle East Policy for the Friends Committee on National Legislation, a Quaker lobby in the public interest, fielding the largest team of registered peace lobbyists in Washington, D.C. She lobbies on avoiding a war with Iran and in favor of an Israeli-Palestinian peace. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kate Gould.
Thanks so much for having me, Ian.
And Kate, obviously there is a lot of moral confusion, if you will, over the situation in Syria, given the nature of the dictatorship, the family dictatorship in Syria that's gone on for the last 40 years, and they've murdered people over the decades back in the early 1980s, destroying an entire town, killing over 20,000 people. Now they've, in response to a popular uprising in the spirit of the Arab Spring, they've just slaughtered their people, but this has led to a civil war. So I've had coverage from reporters in the refugee camps in Jordan who have, you know, talked about the hideous conditions of these people that these refugees are living under and the trauma that they've experienced witnessing their families and their villages massacred by the army. And then on the other side, there's this belief that the rebels have been co-opted by a bunch of crazy jihadis who eat the hearts of their prisoners. So where is the clarity here in terms of how do you proceed to bring peace in this part of the world where the combatants seem determined to kill each other?
Well, as you explained so well, there are gross human rights atrocities on all sides here. It is a civil war. That's how it escalated, even though it did start as this nonviolent uprising calling for greater transparency and as part of the Arab Spring. But today, it is this vicious civil war that has only been exacerbated by the outside actors, by other countries where you have Iran and Russia on one side supporting the Assad regime, by the U.S., Gulf states, other countries supporting the armed opposition, and then, of course, all these this internal fighting between the different armed opposition groups. So that's why seems the only way to stop this killing is to bring all the different warring parties and to the table to reach a political settlement. And that has not been tried to date. So we've seen diplomatic efforts, but they haven't brought in all these groups that you mentioned that are really so much a part of this war.
So the peace, not a peace deal, but the deal that John Kerry and Sergey Lavrov put together, the two Russian and American foreign ministers, that supposedly will disarm Syria's chemical weapons, it does nothing to stop the carnage. And carnage, of course, is fueled by weapons. The Russians are still free to send weapons to, and so are the Iranians, to the Assads. And on the other side, the Western partners and the CIA and the U.S. are free to, and the Saudis and the Qataris are free to send more arms to the Syrian rebels. So that's not a recipe for peace.
That is true. However, it's important to point out that this new diplomatic agreement, which is very significant in dealing and outlining a plan for the disarming of Syria's chemical weapons program, that could be used if it's treated the right way. This moment is seized upon, and diplomacy, as much work as is put into diplomacy as the work that has been put into pushing for war with Syria, and adding another U.S. war in addition to the war going on there in Syria today. If that goes forward, then we could really see this U.S.-Russian deal be used as a starting point for a much broader, a much more comprehensive diplomatic initiative that is based on reaching a political settlement to end the killing, and that brings in all these other actors, Iran, the Gulf states, all the major players in this conflict, and including all the internal factions fighting on the ground, and also the civil society actors that can really lay the groundwork for a better future for Syria. So while this agreement right now is not enough to end the killing, it has important significance for going forward with more diplomacy for reaching a political settlement.
Again, I'm speaking with Kate Gould, who's a legislative associate for Middle East Policy for the Friends Committee on National Legislation, a Quaker lobby in the public interest, fielding the largest team of registered peace lobbyists in Washington, D.C. She lobbies on avoiding a war with Iran and Israel-Palestinian peace. And something I think is going on behind the scenes between the U.S. and Iran. There have been an exchange of letters between President Obama and the new Iranian President Rouhani. And you probably noticed, Kate, that the Iranians just let out, I think, about a dozen political prisoners, some fairly prominent ones. There is some indications that the dialogue is continuing behind the scenes between the U.S. and Iran. Do you think that this Russian-American deal on disarming Syria's chemical weapons could be a kind of blueprint for a way out of the Iranian nuclear situation?
Well, it could be a blueprint, and it could be a blueprint for a way out of the killing in Syria, and also provide some space for getting out of this crisis over Iran's nuclear program. Just a quick correction. So Iran, they freed 11 political prisoners or prisoners of conscience today. But these are many of Iran's most prominent political prisoners, including a human rights lawyer. So that is a very significant step. And as you mentioned, there have been so many pro-diplomacy gestures that we've seen from the Iranian government in recent days. We've seen them on the domestic front, which has important ramifications for the foreign policy field as well, because I think this signals that President Rouhani does have the political authority to really make some real changes inside of Iran and outside of Iran. So that's an important signal to send to the U.S. that it's not just Rouhani on his own, but that he has the capacity to deliver. And then on the international front, then we've seen, in addition to the exchange of letters, we've seen Iran tamper down some of their statements of support for Syria. They've rather than rushing to the defense of Syria, saying that they would supply Syria with arming to them to the hilt in case of a Western attack, they said they would send them food and medicine. You know, they would send them humanitarian supplies. So it's a very different kind of tone from Iran than we're used to hearing on this. So there, and certainly there is a lot of possibility here, lots of opportunity. Of course, President Obama and President Rouhani will speak on the same day at the UN General Assembly, and it does seem like something is going on behind the scenes. That's great to see. Something going on the surface, too, of course, with these letters. And there's new opportunities as well with the whole P5 plus one process. They'll be meeting in New York, and there are rumors they may restart the process with Iran as well, with Iran's new foreign minister. So there's a lot of momentum here. You know, we also saw in July 131 members of Congress called on President Obama to seize this opportunity and engage with President Rouhani. So there's a lot of political support here in the U.S. and seems to be a lot of political support in Iran among elite figures for the U.S. and Iran to reach some sort of agreement, at least on the nuclear issue and perhaps on a broader array of issues.
And Kate Gould, the U.N. report that just came out on the August 21st chemical weapons attack, which fairly clearly implicates the Assad regime. I've noticed that the Iranians have been quite silent on that. Russia is still insisting that Assad is innocent and that's all some clever trick on the part of the rebels. I know that Iran, of course, has very strong feelings about chemical weapons, needless to say, because they were used against them in the Iran-Iraq war. And that brought about, in many ways, the terror that that engendered in the Iranian cities, brought about the end of that war. So how do you interpret Iran's, it's certainly not taking the Russian stance, defending its proxy or ally?
Yeah, I think that is so important to point out. And just the fact that their silence on this issue sends a message in itself, just as the silence on the issue of whether they would increase arms shipments to Syria in light of a Western attack. Or there have been other, of course, right after the chemical weapons attack, then Iran condemned the chemical weapons attack and said, it, of course, at that time they didn't point to the Assad regime. But there was former President Rafsanjani. There are rumors that he said he pointed the finger at the Assad regime. And that's causing a lot of controversy in Iran. There's a major political discussion around that. So I think all these signals are important, and it's important that the U.S. not miss this opportunity. So right now we have in Congress, we have Senator Lindsey Graham, who said that he said a few days ago that he would introduce an authorization for the use of military force against Iran. He said more recently that he would have a legislation that would give the president the green light to attack Iran if negotiations over the country's nuclear program stalls, and that it would encourage diplomacy but threaten, you know, more sanctions and military action. Unclear whether that's going to be a direct AUMF authorization for use of military force or if it's going to be some other kind of threat that could lead to the same outcome. But those sorts of signals from our side really poison the waters here. We have this big opportunity, and Rouhani, in addition to these positive signals, Rouhani's also signaled that he doesn't have forever to go forward with these kinds of openings and gestures of reconciliation, that there are political forces in Iran that don't want to see a rapprochement between the U.S. and Iran, and that if the U.S. responds by threatening regime change or threatening this AUMF, then it could sabotage this opportunity.
So as a peace activist, though, Kate Gould, how do you deal with this situation vis-a-vis Assad's apparent use of chemical weapons against his own people in terms of both the morality and the fact that it's a weapon of mass destruction? You know, the argument that was supposed to have justified a U.S. strike was that a red line had been crossed, and that if the U.S. did not respond, the North Koreans and other regimes around the world would start using chemical weapons. And that's been the argument. So what's your sense of, at this point at the United Nations, it's difficult to know whether the International Criminal Court is going to be invoked, whether there will be sanctions against the Assads, because I think the consensus seems to be that they want this chemical weapons deal to work out, and that's taking precedence over any need to punish the Assads for crossing that line.
Yes. Well, certainly horrifying to see what has happened with the chemical weapons attack and then just over the entire 2.5 years in Syria. And there has to be accountability. The U.S. must pursue accountability for all parties guilty of using chemical weapons or of these other mass atrocities. And so right now is the time that there is, of course, unprecedented international attention on the chemical weapons issue and perhaps on the Syrian crisis, and that the U.S. could use this opportunity to press forward on pursuing the legal, effective, political, and international tools that we have to ensure that there is accountability for the use of chemical weapons. There are some things that have not been tried yet. For example, are convening a high-level meeting of all the state parties to the Chemical Weapons Convention to respond to these violations in Syria. There's 189 countries on that, and now we see that Syria has applied has requested to become part of the Chemical Weapons Convention, which already is a demonstration of the success of the U.S.-Russian agreement, even up to this point when there's so much work left to be done, the vast majority of work is left to be done. But already it's important that the Assad regime has filed to become part of the Chemical Weapons Convention, and that also means that there's greater opportunities for pursuing accountability down the road if it were violated again. So there's also and just again, engaging Iran on this issue is just so crucial because they do have these strong feelings about chemical weapons, and they can use their leverage to prevent another chemical weapons attack, or they're part of the picture about how to prevent another chemical weapons attack in Syria. So it is unclear whether the International Criminal Court will be invoked. It is a path that the Obama administration hasn't fully pursued, taking this to the UN Security Council. So there are a lot of options that have not been pursued, and while one could say, well, they'd be impossible now because of the political climate at the UN, it also seemed impossible that it would work with Russia, that there would be some kind of diplomatic agreement to save the day, and no one thought that Syria would be requesting to become part of the Chemical Weapons Convention so quickly. So a lot of surprises came up, and which shows just how diplomacy often it works at the moment. Just darkest before dawn, that's when these creative diplomatic opportunities are available, and when we can move forward with both preventing future attacks and also providing accountability for the atrocities that have been committed.
Well, on Tuesday, two former Secretaries of Defense, Robert Gates and Leon Panetta, were both critical of President Obama, and Robert Gates said, just quoting him, "My bottom line is that I believe that to blow a bunch of stuff up over a couple of days to underscore or validate a point or a principle is not a strategy. If we launch a military attack, in the eyes of a lot of the people, we will become the villain instead of Assad. It would be throwing gasoline on a very complex fire in the Middle East." I mean, he sounds like a peacenik, doesn't he?
That's right, yes. Yes, well, some of the most vocal opposition to military strikes against Syria were from former officials from the Pentagon. We had various military officials. And then, of course, you saw this overwhelming opposition to military action from the rank and file in the military based on these polls and, of course, from the American public. But, yeah, it just shows how widespread opposition to military strikes were in this case. And now our job is to mobilize all that energy and push it toward, okay, now that there aren't military strikes, and that's off the table at least for now, and of course the world could change tomorrow, but now we have to push that toward getting a diplomatic solution to end the killing in Syria.
So this was a suggestion in the Q&A that took place on Tuesday where Robert Gates was asked whether he could trust Mr. Putin. And, of course, he said, "Are you kidding me?" But then he went on to say that he supported a strategy of sanctions that labeled members of the Assad government as war criminals with the threat of arrest if they left Syria, and suggested sanctions on Assad's family members living or studying overseas, including on their financial holdings. And he thought that such pressure might prompt some of the inner circle to negotiate an end to the civil war. Is that a possibility that you can somehow, because there's so much blood on the Assad's hands, that you could find people, and because there have been a lot of high-level defections from this regime, that you could find people within that regime that wanted to stop the bloodshed?
Well, so there have been a lot of high-level defections. They have petered out recently, and it needs to be recognized that there is still a lot of support for the Assad regime inside of Syria, and that they have been making these military advances. So what's important here is not to find people necessarily who want whose first priority is to end the bloodshed. I don't know if they exist in the Syrian regime. Hard to imagine that they would. But the point is to invite these different representatives from the regime, and who do represent, or rather, who are perceived by many Syrians to represent them, regardless of what we all think of that. And so it's important to bring those people in to a political settlement and as part of these negotiations, because what we do know what they want is to retain some sort of power. They want to be part of some sort of Syria going forward. They want, a lot of the people who support the Assad regime are concerned that in the wake of the end of the Assad regime, that they would be completely, they would be exterminated, that different ethnic groups that have many Christian minorities and other groups have perceived that they have to support Assad for their own protection. So important to bring in these different players to have some sort of representation at the table. You know, for this to work, we actually need to have these players with blood on their hands. I mean, that is how diplomacy can save lives.
Sure. And that's how peace is brought about.
Exactly.
Peace is brought about between enemies, not between friends. So
exactly.
That's the nature of the beast. Well, Kate, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Again, I've been speaking with Kate Gould, who's a Legislative Associate for Middle East Policy for the Friends Committee on National Legislation, a Quaker lobby in the public interest, fielding the largest team of registered peace lobbyists in Washington, D.C. She lobbies in favor of avoiding a war with Iran and for Israeli-Palestinian peace. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.